Welcome. Thank you.
I'd like to take a moment and just briefly cover how we approach things during the interview process, and certainly ask if you have any questions. What we'll do first is invite you to provide your opening statement, brief opening statement, and then council members will have the opportunity to ask you questions. We will try to save 5 to 7 minutes at the very end of our time together to allow you to ask us any additional questions and also for you to provide a closing statement. Do you have any questions for us at this point?
Not now.
Okay. Then we invite you to open. Thank you.
Thank you. I feel like I'm at a Senate confirmation hearing or something here. I feel like I'm at home, though. So thank you, and thank you for inviting me to be here today. It really is an honor and privilege, and I truly believe that. So thanks for having me here today. I want to highlight a little bit about my personal background to start with, and then talk a little bit about how I see some of the challenges that we face moving forward in areas that might be of interest to folks here, and then hopefully that can generate some discussion as well. Most of you, I think, in the room know me as the former MnDOT commissioner, and that's a role that I was very, very proud to serve. I served in that role for about 4.5 years, first under Governor Pawlenty, and then under Governor Dayton. And then it's interesting because I served under a Republican to start with, then I shifted to a Democratic administration, and I was confirmed by a Democratic legislature and then a Republican legislature. So I've gone through the whole gamut of things here. But I truly enjoyed my role as MnDOT commissioner. It was one of my most treasured jobs I've ever had. And it was a tremendous, tremendous experience. I came into that job under some very difficult challenges, though. I came into that job shortly after the 35W bridge collapse. And before that, I was working with the Federal Highway Administration here locally, and the bridge did collapse, and I shifted to become MnDOT commissioner shortly after. And so if you were to ask me one of my leadership challenges that I've had, it was that. Regain public trust and confidence in an agency that was kind of beaten and battered right after the bridge collapse, and how to bring back the morale of that agency in a short period of time so it was a respected agency with everybody. And so that truly was a leadership challenge for me. Beyond that, though, before I came to MnDOT, I had a long career in transportation working for the U.S. DOT. I worked for the U.S. DOT close to 30 years. I moved all over the country. I think when I moved to Minnesota in 2005, this was my 12th move. And you might say, well, you can't hold a job, but that's not true. What I was doing at that point in time was trying to move around the country and get a very good understanding of how different parts of the country work and try to gain some flexibility in the way I think and the way I behave and the way I collaborate within those cultures. For instance, I worked on the East Coast. And when you work within Washington, D.C. or New York City, it's a different culture to gain collaboration and to problem solve than it is in the Northwest and the Southwest and the Midwest. And so in my previous jobs at U.S. DOT, I moved all over the country to try to gain that experience. A couple highlights in those jobs, I landed in Salt Lake City in 2002, and I helped build the transportation infrastructure for the 2002 Winter Olympic Games. And again, that was a tremendous, tremendous experience. It was truly a collaborative effort, and you had to work in a collaborative way because people were coming. And if you weren't ready, you're out of luck. You had to be ready. It was a dynamic, dynamic environment to work in. One of my other key jobs when I was with U.S. DOT, I was in Washington, D.C., working in the policy arena, working with members of Congress to try to move transportation policy back there. And I also led a mega project team. And these were this was a team that worked with $1 billion-plus projects around the country. You might know of one called the Big Dig. I worked with that project as well as others. And that was another great experience that I had. Now, in all these experiences, I had a big tie to the academic community. I worked very closely with research programs in each of the states I was in. I worked with local technical assistance programs in various areas that I've lived in. I worked with historically black colleges and universities as well in some of the states I was in. I was also a big supporter of STEM, and I continue to this day to be a big supporter of STEM. That's my background. That's what I'm passionate about, and I feel very, very strongly that that's the key to our future. I'm also a big supporter of some of the local programs like College Possible. in my current job as in KLJ to support those kinds of programs, and I'll continue to do that wherever I'm at. One thing in my background that most people don't know about that I did want to share, at one point in my life, early in my career, I spent some time at Cardoza High School in Washington, D.C. I went there for about 6 months to try to develop a transportation program. Cardoza High School in Washington, D.C. is an inner-city high school. It's a tough high school with a lot of inner-city issues and problems, gated windows, lockdown situations at the school. And I went there to try to help a transportation academy get started. And I developed a strategic plan. I mentored students when I was there. And it was a great piece of my background, and it truly was a transformational piece of my life. I think that made me who I am today. And I'd like to highlight that because it's an experience in my life that I never forget. Locally, at the University of Minnesota, I've been very active with the Humphrey Institute Center for Transportation Studies. And a couple years ago, when I was MnDOT commissioner, we contracted with the Office of Tourism, and we did a lot of research related to quality of life. And we tried to integrate quality of life research into transportation to make sure our investments that we were making at MnDOT really enhanced quality of life for people. And so I had a lot of interaction with that office as well. In all my experiences, I've been very committed to diversity. I know that's important to the university here. At USDOT, I was very committed to diversity, have been for many, many years. At MnDOT, I tried to do the same both internally and externally. I established a diversity council at MnDOT. I also tried to enhance minority participation in MnDOT contracting when I was there. Having said all this, I think there are many, many great opportunities here at the university, and some that I want to just highlight just for a second. Hopefully that will lead to some discussion, but I think when Governor Dayton became governor, shortly after he became governor, he had an economic summit here in the Twin Cities, right in St. Paul here. The thing that struck me there, the thing I think that probably one of the key things that came out of that is the linkage between academia and the business community. And I think that holds today, and I think that's something we need to be very, very, very diligent about to make sure that the programs we're offering have a tight linkage to the business community, and we look at people that are out there as clients and customers in an academic setting. I also think there's a tremendous opportunity for academia to take a leadership role in the connection between research and the implementation of that research with policymakers. If you look around, I think many of the functional programs at the university, I think there's a lot of outstanding research happening. And I think the difficulty we often have is taking that research and transforming it into reality and implementation. And I think there's a great opportunity here for the university to take a leadership role to close that gap. I always called it the gap between technology and policy. And it's a reality. It's a reality we face not only in Minnesota but in the entire country. And I think the University of Minnesota could take a strong leadership role in closing that technology gap. I think another opportunity is partnering. It's a way of life in our community now, in the industry I'm in. If you don't partner with other people, you won't put the strongest teams out there. And I think there's opportunities here to partner with other people. And the last thing I want to mention is risk management. You know, I'm a big believer in risk management, and particularly enterprise risk management, how risk management integrates into an institution. And I look at the university, and I look at all the great metrics that we have, and there's a lot of outstanding things that we use to guide our future here at the university. The one thing I don't see is how we mitigate our risk and how we incorporate risk management into the way we do business. And maybe that's something that's just not apparent or obvious to me as an outsider looking in, but I think that's a tremendous opportunity for the future, is to incorporate enterprise risk management into the academic setting. And I think I'll leave it at that for now.
Thank you very, very much. Kurt, would you like to start?
I would. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Sorrell. You know, your references to a man and a woman continued to refer to the 35 bridge collapse situation in reference to your good work on that. And I would imagine that is probably one of the most significant challenges you had in your work career. So to me as a layman, that sort of strikes me as being a crisis management situation that you were involved in. Could you tell us a little bit what you learned from that and how whatever you learned and experienced might translate into being a regent at the U of M?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's one I've reflected upon time and again, because when I walked into that situation, I don't think anybody, you don't prepare and train yourself to find yourself in that situation. And so I remember sitting with Governor Pawlenty, actually, when he asked me to become commissioner. It wasn't obvious to me that I wanted to do this. And I said, what am I getting into here? But at the end of the day, you know, I felt that it's going to sound kind of corny, but it was a calling for me. It was a collection of the background and the experience that I had and the leadership skills that I had developed to that point. And I happened to be sitting in Governor Pawlenty's office at that point for a reason, and I couldn't explain it to you, but I just know I was there, and I felt that I could be helpful in leading out of that crisis. And so what I did is I understood that as the transportation commissioner, I was not only leading the agency out of a crisis, I was leading an entire community out of a crisis. The entire transportation industry really was struggling at that point in time because bridges don't collapse. And whether you're an engineer at MnDOT, whether you're an engineer in the consulting world, you were really touched by this in a negative way. And at the same time, you had to respect the victims and their families and whatever strategies you had moving forward. And so I took this as an opportunity to reflect on healing. And I took it as my leadership role as an opportunity to help a community heal. And I started out in that way, and I was very strategic on how I tried to rebuild relationships with the legislature, with the community. I wanted to rebuild public trust and confidence. I wanted to rebuild MnDOT and rebuild morale there. And I felt if I could do all these things and put these pieces of the puzzle together, I'd be successful. And I think at the end of the day, I think a lot of that worked, and I was able to rebuild the national reputation of MnDOT, and that was very deliberate. I felt it was important to provide a strong vision for the agency that could lead us forward and provide a compelling vision for the people that work there. And one of the things I'm most proud of when I left MnDOT was the fact that we had the highest-ranked employee satisfaction of any government agency. Roughly 92% of the people were happy, and the quality of life market research that we did with the public said that most people were fairly confident that MnDOT could do a good job. And so those were things I was pretty proud of. But I think it was more a philosophy of being a servant leader, something that I believe in, and understanding that we had to go through a healing process, and it was okay to go through a healing process. And I think one of the things an employee said in a newsletter they wrote online is that I was very good at leading through a time of crisis and through times of peace. And I really liked that, and I didn't give that much thought until I read her article. And that's something I'm very proud of, that I was able to lead this agency through a time of crisis and also through a time of peace. And I think no matter where you go, whether it's a region here at the university or where I'm at today at KLJ, I think the ability to transfer your leadership skills to a time of crisis or a time of peace is very important, and to understand that there are various leadership skills that you need for various situations and situational leadership. So that's what I'd hope to bring to the table.
Thank you. Pat?
Tom, you mentioned the term enterprise risk management. Would you further explain that, and if you can get maybe as specific as you can about how you think that might apply to the Board of Regents?
Sure. I think what I think of enterprise risk management, it's the ability to take your entire enterprise, your institution, your organization, and assess your risk throughout the organization. And it could go down to the project level, it could go down to the programmatic level, but ultimately it's the organization that you're assessing the risk. And when I was at MnDOT, I started very slowly with this. I did project-level risk assessments, and we pulled apart projects to predict conflict, where conflict points were in projects. And then we did about 70 or 80 risk assessment workshops, and then we started to build that into the organizational structure. And at the end of the day, we started to do programmatic risk assessments and try to ultimately help us define where we may need to make the right investments based on risk. And I'll give you a couple very specific examples. We did a risk assessment of our operations, our mowing, our snow plowing. And I always felt, just as a leader of the organization and input that I've gotten from many people, I always felt that sometimes we might have not had our resources focused the right way. In other words, I'd get complaints about not mowing enough, mowing too much, plowing too little, plowing too much. So I thought something's amiss here. And so we did this very in-depth. We drilled very deep into our maintenance program. And we determined that there were areas, in fact, where we didn't have to mow as much because the public would tolerate something a little less than what we're doing. And yet, and there are certain areas that we needed to do more. And so we were able to reshift or now reallocate our resources from a risk management perspective. We also did that with our pavements. We looked at what the public would tolerate in terms of a poor pavement, and we determined between 5 and 9% as a condition rating of poor pavements that they tolerate. So we started to invest to keep within that risk tolerance band between 5 and 9%. So what I was doing was essentially overlaying all these risk tolerance and risk assessments, overlaying them over each other to come up with an organizational approach to manage risk from an enterprise perspective. And ultimately, what I was doing is trying to make the right investments based on risk, where I can appropriately mitigate risk, where I can accept risk, and that's what I'm saying. And we had many performance metrics, and that was a key to this. And I think any enterprise that can really effectively shift risk around and manage risk appropriately and accordingly can make a better use of funds and a better use of resources in the right way.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just listening to you talk about the bridge, I was very moved because I, you know, was living through it with you when I was on the Transportation Committee. And so, first of all, you know, I'm again reminded by the contribution you made to all of us who went through that. Thank you. Because it was true the organization was in turmoil. So thank you for that healing. Yeah. So, and as we reviewed your references, nobody who provided references were able to talk about your experience with diversity. And so I said that I knew that you had that experience because of the strict laws we have in Minnesota with regard to projects, mm-hmm. including, you know, high levels of diverse personnel. And so I think you did address that in your earlier comments, but if there's anything else you want to say about what it was like to have those state laws and how you managed through that.
That's an excellent question, and quite frankly, the whole idea of diversity in a program like we were managing at MnDOT is kind of a journey, and it's still a journey today because it's never perfect and you never stop. And so what we had to do at MnDOT, we had certain requirements. If you had federal funds, you had to have a certain participation by minority contractors, disadvantaged business enterprises, and that kind of thing. And so we were a little restricted on what we could do and not do based on federal laws. What I chose to do was I kind of characterize it as doing the right thing because I could have very easily, when I was MnDOT commissioner, just administered the laws. And I could have said, Mr. or Mrs. Contractor, you know, this is the requirements for this particular contract. Go out and get it. If you don't get it, I'm going to penalize you. And I chose not to do that because that wasn't transformational and that wasn't where we needed to be in the future. So what I did is I created a workforce and DB collaborative. I brought the unions in. I brought minority contractors in. I brought a lot of various input and stakeholders into this DB workforce collaborative to try to figure out ways which we could work together. And quite frankly, it wasn't always easy. And I ended up having to hire a professional mediator to help with that collaborative. But we ended up forming multiple work groups to try to address some of these issues. And the key to it was to developing a diverse workforce that we could draw upon because we didn't have that. And so I think we made some significant progress. We picked out some pilot projects in the city. Lexington Avenue up near 694 was a project. We debundled that to create opportunities for minority contractors. And at the end of the day, we had 17% participation rate by minority contractors, which was kind of unheard of at that time. Internally, I created a diversity council within MnDOT with an emphasis on making sure we were diverse in the way we looked at things. And I always think of diversity as inclusion and opportunity, and that's how I defined it. And that's the path we went down. And there's any number of things that we did at MnDOT to support diversity and helping us to make us be a better agency related to that. The other one that I'll mention that I'm pretty proud of is we were having trouble with the ADA community, and by that I mean we weren't doing the right things. We weren't doing the right things for the ADA community, and we did a risk assessment. We found, boy, we're at risk here for a tremendous lawsuit at some point in the future if we don't start shaping up. So we formed an ADA collaborative, and we brought leaders and thought leaders from the ADA community in, and we started to pick apart MnDOT practices and figure out how can we be better at this. And we actually had some workshops. We brought some people from the ADA community to our construction sites to figure out how can we better position our construction sites for people with disabilities can maneuver around those sites. And so we're very active in that as well. And so I think that's something that everybody at MnDOT is pretty proud of, that we're able to enhance our facilities for the ADA community as well. So those are some examples.
So point of clarification, ADA is the American Disabilities Act?
That's correct.
Thank you. Sonia?
Mr. Sorrell, the university is losing three senior regents, one who just died and two others who've had tremendous expertise in the area of healthcare, at a time when the university, many believe, enhancing the program and the reputation of the university in healthcare is critical. So as a tremendous leader in transportation, how do you bring characteristics that really helped you in that area to becoming knowledgeable and strategic at addressing healthcare?
That would be an opportunity and challenge I would absolutely love. And I understand that, and I believe many of the skill sets that I've identified here can be transferred very readily. And one of the things I think a strength of mine as a leader is I can put pieces of the puzzle together fairly well, and I can very quickly understand various functional areas. And even though I'm a transportation person, when I was over at the legislature all the time, I was talking about quality of life. I was talking about how transportation enhances public health. And I was talking about towards zero deaths. I was talking about all those things, and I wasn't just talking about transportation. Even though that's my background expertise, I was always relating it to public health. In fact, today, I mean, you can go back in time and find presentations I've made. And I used to do a lot with Ed Erlinger, the health commissioner, and he used to tell people, he used to have people come up to him and say, "Who's the new health commissioner?" They're talking about me.
That's great.
And I said, "I'm sorry, Ed, but I'm just trying to help you here." But that was my methodology and my belief that transportation enhances the quality of life via health, via the environment, via education. And if you look at this quality of life market research I referenced earlier that I did with the Office of Tourism, you can see these definitive linkages between the investments you make in transportation, the investments you make in health, the investments you make in education. And I used to always fold this under the sustainability umbrella and make sure our investments are providing sustainable solutions for the future. So I believe it's all linked together, and I believe that what I'm bringing to the table from a transportation perspective is easily linked into those activities and programs, and I think I have a fairly good understanding of that.
Thank you very much.
Lois?
Madam Chair and Mr. Searle, the university is frequently referenced as a, or if not the, economic driver of the state of Minnesota. And my question goes to that economic strength component and asking you how you would bring what I am assuming is insight. So it's a two-part question. Tell me what your insight is or isn't, number one, and then number two, how that might relate to carrying the university's economic driver strength forward. Greater Minnesota transportation has taken you as a MnDOT commissioner. You have been cognizant of Greater Minnesota and how it serves. I am. Tell me what you learned about the economies of Greater Minnesota when you were dealing with its state transportation system, and how that knowledge would impact your service as a Board of Regent in enabling the reach of the university's economic driving capacity to serve Greater Minnesota.
Sure. You know, when I was in tune with Greater Minnesota via the transportation route, you know, the transportation is a lifeline for many people in Greater Minnesota. And I used to have this we were always in this constant debate over here about the investments in Greater Minnesota, Twin Cities, and they're very legitimate discussions and very valid no matter what side you came down on. In Greater Minnesota, the one thing I was always a strong advocate for was Greater Minnesota Transit. That was the one thing that at the DOT that came out of the general fund. And generally we had a lot of support over here, and I don't think that was ever a question. But we always had to make sure, particularly when new legislators came in, that we spent a lot of time on helping them understand the lifeline of those communities with transportation, and particularly the elderly and folks with disabilities, people that needed assistance. And so I was a very, very strong advocate for Greater Minnesota Transit, and we were able to sustain that for many, many years and grow it during that time. And I think it's a service that needs to continue to grow. And I think, again, the linkage with the university is very critical in those areas in Greater Minnesota, and transportation plays a key role for that. It's not just Greater Minnesota Transit. It's the condition of our highways and our bridges as well in those areas, and making sure they're safe and well maintained. We used to have different standards for plowing roads in Greater Minnesota based on valid market research, which told us what people there value, what people in the Twin Cities value. And we adjusted our, using risk management approaches, we adjusted our plowing and maintenance activities utilizing that. And so I think there's an acknowledgement that Greater Minnesota is critical to our economy as well as what's happening here in the Twin Cities. And so...
Thank you. Margaret?
Yes, Madam Chair. Mr. Sorrell, you have had a hugely successful career. But anyone who's been hugely successful, when they think back, they probably think of a couple of things that they say, oh, if I could turn the clock back, I would have done that differently. Uh-huh. What's an example of something in that area that really, it was in your job jar and the buck stopped with you?
Sure. I've thought about that a lot.
Good. That's the right answer to start out with.
A really good example that I kind of referenced it earlier, when I came to MnDOT as commissioner, there was a lot of consternation about how we're administering our contracts, particularly with the minority communities and disadvantaged business enterprises, and our numbers weren't the best, and I had a lot of groups coming into my office constantly, wanting more active participation in our contracting. And there were very legitimate concerns. But it wasn't obvious to me, how do I fix this? Because it's a tough and difficult situation with all the federal regulations related to contracting, and you're very much hamstrung with what you can and can't do. And yet I knew that I needed to do more than just live by the regulations. That's not who I am, and that's not what I was there to do. And so when I started this DB and Workforce Collaborative, where, as I mentioned earlier, I brought in the unions, I brought in the thought leaders in the communities. They all weren't contractors. They were pure thought leaders in the communities. I brought in this very eclectic group of people to try to help me fix this. Well, very quickly, it turned into a very contentious situation. And I had kind of decided early on that I was going to take some of my own people and we were going to facilitate this discussion. And very quickly, I realized this isn't working. It became very contentious, and There was a lot of concerns coming to the table that had nothing to do with MnDOT. There were just historical perspectives on things, and they just kind of came out through this mechanism that I provided, this facilitated collaborative approach. All these concerns that have been building for years about community values, about what's happening in communities, just started to fester in this environment that I was providing. I said, this isn't what I started this for. And all of a sudden, I was trying to solve a lot of issues that were way outside the scope of what I was here to do. And so I realized I had made a mistake, that I didn't quite understand how deeply rooted some of these concerns are. I took them at face value, which was a mistake. And I should have taken more time to really understand how deeply rooted they were. And they weren't necessarily always related to MnDOT. It was other things, historical perspectives, that started to surface. And so once I understood that, I was very introspective about this, because this is the kind of thing that I need to figure this out. I need to figure out why these relationships were broken. I need to figure out how to fix them moving forward in a collaborative way. And so I just halted the discussion. I told the collaborative, I said, we're going to stop because there's some negativity here that's not productive. There's always negativity. There's always conflict that can be productive, but it wasn't like that. And I recognize that. So I stopped, and I let people know that. And some people weren't happy with that. You know, they wanted to continue. I said, no, this is becoming destructive. I took a lot of heat for that. But then I brought in a professional mediator, and I started some norms and some ground rules on how we're going to behave and operate, things that we didn't have before. And I was able to flesh out some of these deep-rooted issues in a good way. And then we started to form work groups and started to come up with solutions. But that's probably the one thing that I look back on that I misjudged. I think I corrected it, but I misjudged the deep-rooted feelings amongst that group. And then I was introspective about it and corrected it and moved on. But that's the one thing in my bucket that...
Your job jar.
Yeah, yes. My job jar.
Thank you. Bert?
Madam Chair and Mr. Sorrell, you obviously had a distinguished career in the public sector. And if I understand correctly, I think you and some other people have started your own business. And if that is the case, what have you learned in the private sector, and how might that impact your views as a regent, number one? And number two, if you were selected successfully, would you have time?
Okay. The company I work with now is called KLJ Engineering. It's not my company. It's a company that's based out of Bismarck. It's a company of about 800 people, and they've been very successful in the Dakotas, and particularly in the Bakken, with providing engineering services up in the Bakken area. And earlier this year, I had some discussions with that company about starting an office here in the Twin Cities. They wanted to, as people are going to the Bakken, they wanted to come down here. And so I agreed to help them start an office up here. And so that's what I've been doing for the past year, is helping them start an engineering services office here. And we're an office of about, we started with two of us, two guys in a garage. And now we're up to 15, 16 people, and we're doing okay. But it's been, serving as a consultant in the private sector has been a really good experience as well for me. And I've learned a lot through that. And it kind of keeps building for me. It keeps building upon things that I've learned in the private sector and things that I've experienced in the private in my long career in the public sector. I just keep building on that and utilize that in the private sector experience as well. And in the current job that I'm in, profitability clearly drives things, and chargeability is very important. And I've learned why that is true. But I understand it, and it was an easy transition for me to take some of the ideas and principles that I've held very dear to me through the years and just take it to the private sector. And it's worked out pretty well for me to date. And I think one thing I do appreciate, I think, the fact that I have both of those experiences behind me now. I think coming into a role like this, having that would be very valuable for me.
Would you have the time if selected?
I would have the time.
Thank you. Jerry?
Yes, Madam Chair, Mr. Sorrell. You have been involved in some large organizations with budgets even bigger than the university. Very widespread variability in the nature of the business. And how would you translate that to work on the Board of Governors of the university? Or the other thing, second part of that is you had mentioned the development of partners. Who or how might you do the partnering? Who would be the partners that you would suggest the university ought to be involved with?
Sure. Yeah, that's true. When I was at MnDOT, I had a close to $5 billion biennial budget and had 5,000 people in that agency. I didn't always have that. I mean, before I landed in that job, I supervised and managed 23 people in the local Federal Highway Administration office. And so I think it was an anomaly for me to land in that spot. It's probably an anomaly for most people to land in that spot where you have that level of budget and people. But what I knew there in that job when I went there is I had to really surround myself with key people that reflected certain values and leadership approaches that I value as well. Not that we agree. I didn't want people to agree with me all the time. But at the bottom line is we had to have similar values in the way we administered that program. And so I really depended on them, and that's the nature of servant leadership. You use the people around you, and you serve the people around you, and I'm here to help them succeed. And I really use, from a financial perspective, I use my CFO. From an operational perspective, I use my chief engineer. And all those people, you know, I was there to provide overall leadership to those folks, and I was very very much okay with supporting them, whether they come over here to legislature or go meet with key customers or groups of people. Very supportive of them, let them do that. So I let them do their jobs. Transferring that kind of approach to the board of directors to me is very similar in that a board is here to provide guidance and overall direction and make decisions when necessary. And I've looked at all the guiding principles of this board and all the policies, and they're very sound. And they're great pieces of documentation that leads this board already. And so that, to me, is a key to any board being successful, is to having those expectations laid out, those guiding principles. And then the purpose of the board is to work within those guiding principles and have a nice balance between the president and his staff and the leaders at the university. And at the end of the day, we all want to collaborate and do the right things and support each other and walk out of the room supporting each other. Board has a role. President has a role. His leadership team has a role. But at the end of the day, we want to all walk out and do the right things. And I think the experience that I had at MnDOT, you know, I always viewed the legislature as a board for me. You know, the Transportation Committee was my board. And I viewed it that way. And I, you know, whether it's Senator Bonhoff or anybody else over here, I would always tell them, look, I'm your policy advisor. You know, I'm not here to make political decisions. I'm your policy advisor. I want to give you the best information you can have to make the decisions you need to make within the framework of what you're thinking. And sometimes, you know, I come over here and I knew a legislator had a certain opinion on something, but I would just lay out very honestly what my thinking was and give them the information they need to have to make the right decision in their mind. And that's fine. That's my role. My role is not to make policy. That's the role of the legislature. And so that's the approach I always took, is to be an advisor to people over here at the legislature. And I was very non-political or apolitical in the way I did that, I think. And so I think that would serve me well in this capacity, too. So.
Can I just – it's actually a second question. You mentioned in your first statements that you think we need to partner with other people.
Oh, right.
People.
I'm sorry.
Who
I didn't
might
those
partners
that.
Be? That's really a separate question.
Sure. I'm sorry. I'm going to go with the transportation arena a little bit here. I know that there are opportunities out there when you're trying to get federal grants, federal funding, and I know there are some universities out there with very strong engineering programs. When they're putting together those kinds of applications, they'll find the right team. It may not be the team entirely within their university, but they'll go find the right the strongest researcher, the strongest academic person to match with somebody from this university, and they'll jointly submit applications for federal funds. And I think there's opportunities here to do that kind of thing more and more. That's kind of the world I live in right now. If for me to win work, I have to form teams. It's not just KLJ. I got to go find somebody at PB sometime for bridge experience, somebody at ACOM for another set of experience. And we pull together these teams at the end of the day to win the work. And at the end of the day, what you're really doing is providing the best product you can for the public. And so I just think there's opportunities in the academic community to do more of that kind of thing and work with the feeder schools, work with these niche schools and try to partner with them, work with STEM programs, not only in this state but around the country, to partner with STEM programs like College Possible, and things like that to partner. And really, at the end of the day, we want to be known as the University of Choice. You know, that's how we know we're successful. We want to be the first university people think of. That's not just students and families. That's the business community. That's the public sector is trying to have some research provided to them or for them. We want to be known as the university that they go to first. And to do that, I think you have to have the strong inclination to partner when appropriate.
Thank you.
So I'm going to ask the closing question and then invite you to move right into your closing comments. The first question that I have for you is, what do you believe would be the most difficult part for you in terms of assimilating immediately into the role of a member of the Board of Regents?
I think the most difficult part is just, this is a very complex organization structure, and I know that just having worked on the fringes of it, you know, at the Humphrey School and CTS and other things that I've done here at the university, it's a very complex organization and the complex relationships and the need to nurture those relationships. And I think that would be the toughest thing for me to step into, and I think I can do it. It's very similar to what I've done wherever I've gone. But I think that's the hardest thing for anybody new coming into this, is just get a very good understanding of the complexity of this university, what it means to the economy, what it means to people's quality of life, and all the information that's out there, and assimilating it and pulling it together in a way that you can be an effective member of the board.
Yeah. Thank you. So with that, we'll let you move to your closing remarks.
Sure. Well, again, thanks for having me here today. You know, I've had people ask me before I even came here, why would you want to do this? And they said, you already went through the bridge collapse. Why would you do this? This is truly an exciting thing for me. And people that know me, they know that I have a passion for enhancing people's quality of life of people around me, whether it's when I was at USDOT, whether it's when I was at MnDOT or my current jobs. You know, they know that I'm passionate about that. And what I really like is to enhance people's quality of life in some way or fashion, but also link it to the academic community. And I've done that my entire career. I've done it with myself personally, but I've also nurtured and mentored many students throughout my life. And I've participated in many academic environments to try to nurture those situations to enhance people's quality of life. And when I say quality of life, again, I'm not just talking about students. I'm talking about their families. I'm talking about the business community. I'm talking about the whole pieces of all the pieces of the puzzle that come together, and the academic community is part of that, and the university is a key part of that here in Minnesota. So I think it's something that I'd absolutely love. I'd be passionate about. I think my servant leadership style of leadership would be very apropos for this environment as well. I think the perspectives that I can bring from a national perspective and actually a global perspective based on my past is something that could really be helpful here. And what I mean by that is one of the things I think that a strength that I have is that I can take these perspectives that are out there, whether national or global, but I can understand them from a local context, from a regional and local context, and bring them into an environment where it makes sense to grow the local economy, grow the regional economy. And there's examples of that all over the Twin Cities in transportation. A lot of what you see around here is based on activity that occurred in other parts of the world. all the technology that you see. So I think that's a strength that I have that I could bring to the table here in this capacity. And as I said earlier, I truly define success as being seen as an institution of choice, whether it's here, whether it's where I work now. That's always what's driven me, to be seen as an institution of choice. And I think university, in many ways, already is that. But I think we have to be diligent about that, being a university of choice for businesses, for the public sector, for families, for students. And those are things I'd be very passionate about if I made it here.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to speak with us today.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
You would still be building bridges.